Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS, and my name is Roy, Romeo Oscar Yankee, and this is the Limarc Technical Net. Limarc Technical Net has been going on since 1982, and it continues every Sunday night at 8 p.m. As always, like to remind people that if you have any questions that you can't direct via radio, if you need to contact me using some other method, either with a question or a topic of interest or a puzzle, we love puzzles. We've gotten a few contributions for puzzles that I'll be reviewing. If you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at some space-related stories, the email to reach me would be mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag at, my call sign is AlphaCharlie2GulfSierra.com. I have available a whole bunch of interesting links. Some of them are visual, so we're not going to really discuss it on the radio, but I thought I would share them with you. Others include articles that, if we have time, we'll get into during the Science Talk segment. And they're all available. They'll be up there 24/7. You can go and look at them at your leisure, click and watch the interesting YouTubes and read some of the interesting articles. And those can be found by just typing into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com. There's a chat room available. You can either go to Limarc's own website and look for the link to the chat room, or you can type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the chat room. I stream audio of W2VL 7 days a week, 24 hours a day for the most part, except when I'm rebooting my computer. So if you would like to be able to access it using your cell phone or any computer that has a browser, you can use it by just typing into the browser technet.ac2gs.com. And as always, want to remind people of Mike, AC2NJI, has a great archive site. He has the technical nets going as far back as September of 2006, and that's available at his website, amateurradio.tv. So please avail yourself of it at your leisure. There's a lot of wisdom, a lot of very smart men who are now, unfortunately, silent keys, with great advice that continues to be great. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you our plans for tonight. Okay, as always, I will ask if anyone has any questions of a technical nature, and we'll write down their first name and their call sign, and we'll try and get to them in order. Around 8:30 or so, we'll have a new installment of Andy's Corner. Andy will be giving a discussion on galvanic corrosion by dissimilar metals, something that we've all had to deal with in mounting antennas to different materials and such. So he's going to get into that subject, and I hope you find it interesting. I certainly will. From that point on, when he's done, I will come back and we will continue any of the other questions that are on the list, if we didn't get to them before Andy's Corner. And I'll open things to general scientific and medical discussions. No specifics, but if you want to discuss something in the news, or something that you've been thinking of that has to do with science, there is a particular experiment that's been written up a lot. It's called the muon G-2 experiment. It was done in Fermi Lab. An earlier version was done not very far away in Brookhaven Institute, the lab there. And this is an extension of Brookhaven's lab's experiments into muons and their dipole moments and why it's important. So if we have a chance, we'll go into a little discussion on that subject. Then we will, around 10:15 or so, call upon Paul, WS2N, and he will present us with the SpaceNet report, which should take us to approximately 11 p.m. We'll come back and tie a bow on it and wish you well and call it a night. So that's my plan. Hopefully the repeater will allow us to do all these things. And hopefully we'll have some good participation out there, because that's what makes or breaks a technical net. So I will drop for a second, and then I will ask people if they have any questions of a technical nature to give me their first name and their call sign.
KG2RY. David, good evening.
David recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
KG2OGB here.
Okay, Craig recognized. I got you down on the list. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? We'll always take late check-ins for questions, but if you want to get your name up on the list early and get it over with, that's great too. So if you have a question of a technical nature, please give me your first name and your call sign. Rob recognized. Okay. Anyone else with a question want to get their name on the list? Now's as good a time as any. So if you have a question that you think you would like to discuss, please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, let's start with the top person on the list, David, KG2RY. What's your question for tonight, David?
Good evening, Roy. Hope you're having an excellent night. Hope everyone is having an excellent night. I want to have some kind of Windows 10 ready computer, but I don't want to go out, buy a laptop or another computer. It just takes up too much space, you know? So my idea is to install Windows 10 on my Mac with Boot Camp, but the problem is, you know, for some reason it will not allow any software to drive a COM port. What do you know about this?
Well, unfortunately, not being an Apple user, I mean, I have an iPad, but I've never really had an Apple computer. I don't have a lot of experience with that. One of the that's a strange thing. I would think that if you are legitimately booting into Windows, it should be able to access the COM ports. I don't quite understand. Where you would probably have a problem accessing COM ports is if, rather than a dual boot, if you selected a virtual device, a virtual machine, a VM, what that does is it will simulate a computer inside the operating system, the native operating system. So in other words, a virtual machine on Apple OS X would then run Windows inside itself. And the problem is that the hooks for things like COM ports sometimes have problems accessing the external hardware. So you're saying that doing a complete dual boot, you have problems accessing the COM ports on your Apple machine?
Maybe on the other machine that I had, it was running System 11, Big Sur, and that might have been the problem. Maybe I could try it again on my old machine and see if that makes a difference.
KD2OGB question.
Yes, Greg, you want to ask something?
What's your highest software update on your MacBook, Dave?
Well, this is not a MacBook. It's an iMac. The one that I'm using now, 10.5.7, Catalina, OS Catalina. The one I was trying, you know, to partition and to install Windows 10 and run the COM port on was System 11.2.3.
Okay, so Catalina you're talking about. I don't know if a Mac OS X that new would be able to handle stuff like that, even if you try to boot in through Boot Camp. I mean, people could still use Boot Camp and get maybe Vista or XP, but I don't know about that. Considering that it's 2015, I don't know, but I'm sure Roy could provide more answers on that, but I mean, Catalina, I don't know if it could perhaps handle Windows 10, even if you're dual booting and then partitioning stuff, so keep trying.
Yeah, well, this iMac is from late 2012. It's the latest version of Catalina, but it's not the latest software version. This computer is too old for Big Sur anyway. I'm not sure what I'm going to do. I might just go out and buy a laptop.
Well, you know, nowadays the price of you know, medium to low spec laptops is very competitive. They've become somewhat commodities. As long as you're not planning to run some massive video editing experience, I would be curious. In what way does the COM ports not work? Does the operating system not recognize that the COM ports are even available, or does it say that it doesn't have the proper drives for them? In what way does it fail?
Like most of what you, outside of what it's really intended to do, give it a try.
KC2FYJ with a suggestion.
Yes, Harry.
Harry.
Yes, Harry.
You might consider checking into the ComputerNet third and fourth Wednesdays of the month on this repeater. I think they start at 8:30. It might be 7:30. I don't remember. If you check into the InfoNet tomorrow night, you could inquire about that.
Yes, sir. I think I'm going to try that. And there was a doubling. It was Roy and Craig. I don't know for how long, but what did I get? I think Roy was talking about laptops and the price of laptops, and there was something else that I don't remember what it was. I guess the idea is to see if this old computer can run Windows 10 with the COM port recognized. I couldn't. On the newer computer, I wasn't able to even install the COM port driver. It wouldn't take the software.
Okay, so that would be an incompatibility probably with your hardware, I would think, not the operating system, because the whole idea, as far as I'm aware with Boot Camp, is it's a separate, it's from the BIOS, right above the BIOS booting. So it would natively install Windows in a partition, and you'd have a selection when you booted up the BIOS of whether it would go to the Macintosh of, operating system or the Windows. So is it possible that Windows doesn't have a driver for these types of COM ports anymore? I mean, this is a possibility. You might have to downgrade your Windows to something before 10.
QSL, I think Craig was saying something like that. But the hardware was new and the software was new. System software was new. Maybe it'll work on this older computer. And I think maybe the third and fourth Wednesday evening, I should find out more, you know, before I do anything, if it's possible to run it on Catalina.
Okay, certainly, you know, the computer net is available. Ken usually pops in a little bit later on tonight. He has other nets that he's involved with as well. So either wait for his computer net, or if and when he pops up, you might want to avail him of information. But I'm a little confused. The computer that you used and it failed, this is a brand new computer? This isn't the old one that you've had since 2012 or something?
The new computer is late 2019. It had OS Big Sur 11.2.3 system software, and the one that I'm using now, as I downgraded, is late 2012, and it has Catalina 10.15.7, and it seems to be working okay. You know, a difference, you know, in terms of the operating system isn't that much different from one to the other.
Okay. I mean, as long as you have it there, I would think that it would probably be an interesting and somewhat useful experiment to try the other computer. Sometimes computers have something set up within their registries and such, where two computers that are pretty much equivalent, one will take to a program and set it up correctly, and the other one might falter. So as long as you have the option of another one, you might want to consider trying that. But again, as Harry mentioned, certainly ask Ken and the people listening on the computer net, on the, I believe it's the second and third Wednesdays of the month.
WB2KWC.
Ah, Ken, how are you?
I'm doing fine. The computer net is the third and fourth Wednesday of the month at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And I've heard part of this conversation, and I guess the thing that's confusing me is you're talking about a dual boot system, and I'm failing to see why the version of the Macintosh operating system would have anything to do with it. I mean, basically, once you have booted into a Windows environment, wouldn't you be basically running Windows on the bare metal? Or is there something that the Macintosh does to, shim between the bare metal and Windows?
KD3OGB, that's what boot camp's used for.
Yeah, Craig, I understand that's what boot camp is for. Let me just see if I have the repeater. Okay. It's just that the way that David describes the problem, it's almost like boot camp isn't just a BIOS overlay that branches from either Windows or the Mac OS. It sounds more like a virtual machine, which I'm not quite sure. I don't think that's how it works, but if it was a virtual machine, it would make a lot more sense why Mac OS's virtual machine is having problems connecting with the Windows COM ports to the actual hardware. The only other thing that I can think of is if there's some kind of problem with the hardware versus Windows OS, that for some strange reason the hardware isn't amenable to it, which I find sort of hard to believe. I would think that they throw everything as far as drivers into the Windows 10 kitchen sink. But that was one of the reasons why I suggested trying a earlier type of Windows, Windows 8 or Windows 7, and maybe there would be a more compatible available COM port driver.
Let me just be more specific. What I was trying to do was I wanted to upgrade the firmware in my HF radio, the Yaesu Fox Tango 891. And I use a Yaesu software, you know, and I want to put the Yaesu driver for this particular transceiver into the Windows partition installed through boot camp, and I did it with System 11. System 11 is a brand new operating system. That means that there can be all kinds of problems with it, you know. So maybe Catalina will allow it to work.
Okay, I mean that's a possibility. Again, the most important thing for me, and I'll start Googling it, because again, I don't have that much experience with Apple computers for the most part. I like their iPads, but when I had to make my choice, I picked IBM PC compatibility computers. But my big question is it really a hidden virtual machine in which the COM ports are kind of problematic? Because otherwise, it would be you'd be installing the operating system Windows 10 on bare metal, as Ken mentioned, and then it would no longer be a factor of the Macintosh operating system. Once you got past the boot options, you should be free of anything related to Macintosh, except for the hardware, of course. The software should have gone bye-bye. So I'm not quite sure what's going on here either.
QSL, I know what you mean, and that's a good question, and I think we have to find out. I don't know if we have the answer right now.
Well, like I always said, Google is your friend. So, I mean, I'm going to Google the subject because I would like to learn more about it. And I would suggest that you Google it as well. And you might come up with some interesting information in addition.
QSL. Yeah, I used the Google to figure out how to install the Windows operating system. And it did boot up, and I did, was able to do some things in Windows. But even then, for some reason, the trackpad and the keyboard and all the functions, it was running kind of weird and slow, and it didn't make any sense. So maybe, I get some more information and try it on the old computer.
Yeah, I would say you have the equipment. Hopefully you have the time. I would experiment and see what happens. I mean, just as a side note, just for the audience, the newer generation of Apple products are not going to have this dual boot capability because they've repeatedly jumped CPUs through their times. And once again, they're jumping out of the Intel CPU into their own proprietary M1 RISC-based CPU, which apparently runs like gangbusters from the preliminary software reports that I've heard. So it's going to do away with the whole concept of boot camp because, unfortunately, there is no Windows written for the M1 CPU processor that's going to be Apple's big new idea. So just to educate people out there about what's coming, the M1 chip. But I would try the other computer, and please, if you find something new out, come back next Sunday or whenever you have a chance and tell us how it went.
Certainly. Thank you very much, Roy. I appreciate it. And have a great night.
Thank you, David. Well, let's see. It's 8:23. Now it's 8:24. And Andy has told me he's got to make this a short night with us. So let me I hope that Craig and Rob don't mind if we put their questions on hold for a little while for Andy's corner. Is that okay with you, Craig and Rob?
Yeah, but on one thing. Make sure Ken is fine, too, because he just tapped in a second ago.
Okay. I don't think Ken tapped in for a question. I think Ken tapped in to tell us the proper time for the computer net.
Okay. This is WB2KWC. The computer net is on at 8:30, the third and fourth Wednesday of the month.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ken. So hopefully Craig and Rob can stand by for a while, a little while. And I will ask Andy if he'd like to come by and give us this edition of Andy's Corner.
Yes, I would. And I'm here. I'm using a different radio, so it may sound a little bit strange because I'm getting used to this new Yaesu FTM-400, which has been sitting here for a long time, and I haven't put it on the air except till now. So let me say hello to everyone. This has a lot of audio. I may have to make some adjustments on it, but we'll see how it works out. I am listening to myself, and this is Andy's Corner. My name is Andy, and my call is WA2CDL. Okay, so you don't have to walk away from your radios, guys, and be concerned and put your masks on and everything else, because I will say that I've had my second vaccine, and that was a week ago last Friday. So it's been, so this Friday will be 2 weeks since I've gotten the second Moderna vaccine. And interesting little side effects that I'm sure that Roy has spoken about before, which I've witnessed and felt and everything else that goes with that. So you don't have to be scared and run away from me, because I am vaccinated and I'm pretty safe. I just thought I would add that in, because you never know that what can pass through the microphone into the wire and come out the radio of your end. So, with that little joke being aside, it may not be such a joke either, I found an interesting article in the QST magazine going back to 2017, August of 2017, by Ward Silver, N0AX. And he does articles on what's called hands-on radio. And this is an actual experiment called dissimilar metals. And I think we've all come in contact with dissimilar metals, but really didn't understand what that means and what happens when you have what we call galvanic action. So I'll read this article and see if we can absorb a little bit of it to get a better idea, because when we put antennas up, using dissimilar metals as masting and piping and whatever else that we use, whatever else we have, can cause some interesting problems, which I've actually seen in the field due to this galvanic action. It actually can generate voltages, it can cause intermod, it can cause a lot of problems, a lot of different things. On this, because it is a fascinating subject, and Roy can actually add a lot to this, because Roy, being the field that he's in, he's a chemist in a way and has a lot of background in the chemistry of different things, because chemistry itself is an interesting subject. So doing a quick Google search, let me see if I can just find a quick answer that may summarize. I just lost it. Let me see if I can pull it up. Okay, well, this is called galvanic corrosion, because it does cause metals to corrode. And I'm sure we've seen metals corrode, like rust. You know, you want to get into the discussion of what is rust. When something rusts, what happens? You know, it looks disgusting. The metal falls apart, and some metals rust and some don't. And you can ask the reasons, you know, why is that, why does that occur? It has to do with the chemical makeup of the material that makes up the metal, or the chemical makeup of the metal itself. So, according to Google, and actually this is This is galvanic corrosion. I was asking what is galvanic action. And let me just see if I can find that one, because it just gave me the wrong information. Stand by. Okay, you see, it's, my computer's playing games. So what is meant by galvanic action? According to what Google says, and it's an interesting thing to know, galvanic action occurs when two electrochemically dissimilar metals are in contact and a conductive path occurs for electrons and ions to move from one metal to the other. One metal corrodes as its ions are deposited onto the other metal. So there we have a little bit about corrosion, you know, what would cause something to corrode. It's losing its electrons, and when you lose an electron, it becomes what we call ionized, ionization. That happens in tubes. And just to mention, the older style mercury vapor rectifier tubes because of the high voltage on the plate, it becomes ionized. The electrons of the mercury vapor are attracted to the, because the electrons are negatively charged and the plate is positively charged, because of unlike charges attract, like charges repel. Because of that action, you have more electrons flowing in a mercury vapor rectifier tube, so therefore that tube can carry a higher amount of current. Normal rectifier tubes that uses a filament, and just using the filament without a cathode, only produces a certain amount of electrons. That electron cloud is produced and formed around the filament, and then, of course, because of the positive charge on the plate, the electrons will be attracted to the plate. So the amount of electrons, the number of electrons, determines the amount of current that flows. Anyway, I'm just getting into that just to give an idea. So there's a similarity, and it has to do, the common thing about it is that, you know, like charges repel and unlike charges attract. And it's the same thing for semiconductors, solid-state devices, diodes, things of that nature. And I'm not reading this, by the way, I'm just mentioning it, because when you have, although the chemical makeup of the germanium or the silicon or the gallium arsenide. Okay, luckily I have a timeout timer in this radio, so that's why I'm using it. So I don't have to time out. The chemical makeup is purposely doped. It's called doping, where they actually they add an impurity to the chemical. You know, they add an impurity to the silicon or the germanium, so it causes either an extra electron, or it reduces an electron, which causes an electron to be missing, which leaves a hole. So electrons and holes flow, which becomes P-type material and N-type material. That would create, basically creates your PN junction, which is your diode, your solid-state diode. The reason why they call it solid-state, or I should say semiconductor, they call it a semiconductor in a solid-state device, is because it's not really a good conductor and it's not really a good insulator. It's somewhere in between. Anyway, the principle is basically the same. By the way, Roy, let me ask you, because I'm listening to myself, is the audio acceptable on this, or should I change? Because I'm listening to something I don't like to hear. How do I sound to you, Roy? Am I okay?
Well, you're completely understandable, but it doesn't sound like you. There's a lot of hash and noise. You might be overdriving the microphone amplifier or something, but there's a kind of mushiness that's going on. Also, It's kind of mid-tone. The sibilants are kind of missing, so it's not the best sound I've heard you.
Yeah, I didn't set up the microphone audio. There's a number of settings. Stand by. Let me go back to the other radio. I'll be right back. WHCDL.
KD2, QOT listening, mobile.
KD2, UDU, Roy, put me on the list for later.
Okay, you're on the list.
KD2, QOT listening, how am I coming in?
You're coming in fine, full quieting.
Thank you very much.
Okay, let me just change my power level. I don't really need... That's not bad. Okay. All right, WHCDO. This is the way I normally sound. This is a different radio. A little bit better, Roy?
Yes, better.
All right, I'll have to set up the other one. There's a number of settings for the microphone, levels and gains and this and that. So sorry about that, guys. The other radio has a timeout timer built in. This one does not, so... I thought it would make it a little bit easier, so I don't time it out. Okay, so I just gave a little dissertation on as far as corrosion, what causes corrosion and so on. But we'll get into this little article on dissimilar metals, and that'll clarify it. It's only 2 pages. And I also hear Wayne out there and everyone else is checking in. Okay, so... This is what Ward says. When putting up my station with Tower Maven Don Dasso, K4ZA, and he's a tower installer, he's an antenna man, I got an earful of good advice about what happens when different types of metal are clamped together out in the weather. There's a hint. It's nothing good. All right, so this is actually a good lesson to you guys out there who are going to put antennas up, because even I'm aware of it, but I don't practice it, although I should. Don gave me some good tips on how to manage the situation at reasonable cost, because metal-to-metal connections are so common in amateur antenna and ground systems, I thought it was a great candidate for a hands-on radio column. So here we go. And again, Roy, if you want to jump in to the electrochemistry at work. Atoms that have an affinity for electrons are called oxidizing agents. Okay, so I'll just repeat that again. Atoms that have affinity for electrons are called oxidizing agents. Because you've heard the term, what is oxidized? It's oxidized. You've probably seen what it looks like. Similarly, atoms that donate electrons are called reducing agents. Just like I said, in solid state or semiconductor activity, you have a donor electron and you have a receiving electron. And that's how you get conductivity, from one state, one junction, a P junction or an N junction. It's the same principle, only that was man-made because it was a chemical that was changed purposely to cause that solid state action, to create the solid state, device.
But this is an actual metal. You know, this is something natural. The way the metal is, the compound of the metal, the electrochemistry of the metal, you know, for instance. So, as I said, it's just for information. There is a whole range of strengths of oxidizing and reducing agents. The greater the difference between the material's relative affinity for electrons, the stronger the reaction between them can be. Is that a comma or a period? I can't tell. Okay, the stronger the reaction between them can be, with atoms of one material acquiring electrons from the donating material in an oxidation reduction reaction. So that's what it's called. It's called an oxidation reduction reaction. The relative difference in strength is called electropotential. Now, of course, you know, these are just terms that they use, electropotential or oxidation and everything else. You know, basically what you wanted to see is the concept of, you know, two dissimilar metals, one being a donor of electrons, the other a receiving electrons. And that's what causes all your corrosion and everything else. And that's what you got to keep in mind. You know, all these other terms, you know, he's just using. If two materials with different electropotentials are in contact with each other, there is a conducting path between them. Electrons will move from the reducing to the oxidation, or oxidizing, I should say, from the reducing to the oxidizing agent. So again, it's going to be I'm going to restate it. It's going to cause a conducting path of electrons. They'll move from the reducing to the oxidizing agent. Now, what this does, this results in a change in the chemical makeup of the two materials. When the reaction occurs between parts of our antenna system, we apply a more of a descriptive word. It's called corrosion. And I'm sure, you know, people say, "Oh yeah, I've seen corrosion, but I don't know what it is." So they have a basic idea what it actually is. Corrosion. Corrosion is generally bad because the result of the reaction is generally a compound with less strength and conductivity than the original metal. Ah, now they talk about rust, you see? Rust is one such corrosion product, and is so that, and is so is that it's crusty stuff that builds up on your car's battery terminal. All right, so they're showing it as a crusty stuff on your battery terminal, which is rust. All right, corrosion can proceed until the connection no longer conducts current or fails mechanically. In other words, the wire, antenna, or tower falls down. Now you can see how serious that is. You don't want your antenna falling. You don't want your tower falling, for sure. And you don't want your wires breaking. So you got to be careful as far as your dissimilar metals to stop this, you know, reaction from happening. Okay, because not everything is made from the same metal, contacts between dissimilar metals are very common. If the metals are kept dry, corrosion proceeds slowly. He uses the word proceeds. I could use the word progresses, you know, whatever. The corrosion will occur, but it's at a slower rate. But outside, the water from rain, because the rain is not, you know, the rainwater is not pure water. Rainwater itself has a nice chemical makeup to it. And does cause things to corrode, we know that. And condensation, which is a, you know, which is water that's condensated, collects in the junction. This creates the conducting path, enabling electrons to flow and cause corrosion. Okay, by the way, Roy, just because I'm talking about electrochemical, just, you're following what I'm saying so far? Makes sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. The underlying concept is that all metals are conductive. They all have delocalized electrons, which allow them to be conductive. But their attraction to the nucleus is different strengths. So if you have two dissimilar metals that have different strengths holding their electrons, the stronger one will pull out the electrons from the weaker metal, and in any kind of humidity, any water in the air, it will basically reduce the water back to oxygen, and the oxygen will combine with the metal and cause corrosion.
Okay, very good. Yep, that basically, you know, summarizes what I, you know, said. And, of course, now you're going to ask, you know, how does this affect our, you know, antenna installation? And so he goes on to say that the galvanic series and anodic, and I believe that's the way it's pronounced, A-N-O-D-I-C, anodic index, which they actually have a chart where you could figure out, you know, how much corrosion and how much galvanic action will occur depending on the type of material and, you know, the type of metal you're going to use. And it's also, by the way, it's reference to gold. Gold has a very high conducting factor. Gold contacts are used in high-performance test equipment. I know Hewlett-Packard used a lot of gold contacts on their circuit boards. Because of the low resistivity of the gold, and because it's has low resistivity, means that it's got a higher conductivity. You know, it's just the opposite of resistance is conductance, and that's because you have a greater amount of electrons, and you want to keep the resistance low. So I'm just adding that little tidbit to that. So we'll go on from there. We'll mention the chart in a little while of what the anodic, however you want to pronounce it, index, and what that is. So it says it is useful to know which materials can, quote, get along and which cannot get along. Chemists developed a list called the galvanic series. In other words, ranking materials from the strongest electron donors to the most inert material. The farther apart the two materials are in the series, the stronger the reaction between them will be. Okay, so what they do is they call the more active material will act as the anode. You know, you have an anode and a cathode in a diode, so it's the same principle. So the more active material will act as the anode, which donates the electrons. You know, and that would be the filament in a tube, because it's electrons are being formed in the heated filament. Okay, remembering that chemistry is based on electronic current. It's the flow of electrons, not the conventional current, which is the flow of positive charge that is used, you know, in radio electronics. That could be a little bit confusing, but he adds this in. Okay, so I'm going to say that again. Remember that chemistry is based on electronic current. the flow of electrons and not conventional currents, which is the flow of positive charge that is used in radio electronics.
Andy? Andy, do you hear me?
Which way does current flow, from negative to positive or positive to negative? You know, it's always a question. Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, well, that's a historical problem. They had a 50-50 chance of getting it right, and they got it wrong. They thought the charge carriers were positive, they're negative. So it's only in diagrams that the current flow is the wrong way and describes positive charge going in that direction. So from a schematic or a descriptive level, they're right, but functionally, electrical current is the same as anything else. It's the flow of electrons. We write it as the opposite direction because we got it wrong historically. But it's still electrons are traveling through conductors and providing us with electricity. A positively charged objects are ions. They're much heavier. And they don't really move in wires and such. So electricity is really still negatively charged electrons, although we decided to write it the opposite way.
Okay, I'm glad you said that because that's why I was hoping you would have chimed in right there and there because there's always that question, which way does electron flow, which way does from negative to positive to negative, and so on. But yes, that's exactly right. It is a little bit confusing. So, okay, let me let it drop. Okay, so as we know, or maybe we don't know, electrical potential can be measured with a voltmeter. And although they call it electrical potential, trying to think of the word, there's another word for it when you're measuring a voltage between two points, point A and point B. EMF, electromotive force is voltage. They call it that. So, another term. Can be measured with a voltmeter, and it's measured in volts. It is what Alessandro Volta, and that was the guy who, I guess, made these discoveries, discovered and made the use to create the voltaic pile, known today as a battery. Because batteries use basically the same principle, if you think about it, and we're gonna actually build a battery. In the next page is a little bit of an experiment you guys can do if you want to make one. So it says, because electrical potential is a relative difference, it is measured as a voltage with respect to some reference material. That voltage is a metal's, again, ANODIC, anodic, if you want to say it that way, index. So that voltage, the difference is that metal's anodic index with respect to gold as the reference material. And as I said before, they're using gold as a reference point. And I guess because, Roy, you can clarify this, maybe when they first were looking at the properties of different metals, they landed on gold, I'm assuming, because they found that gold is the most conductive. I thought it was silver, actually. I thought it was a toss-up between gold and silver. I always thought silver was more conductive than gold, and I got to look that up. But they chose gold, Roy, just to let you know. Obviously, you knew that, but that was interesting, Roy. Go ahead.
Yeah, anodic index is not the same as conductivity. Silver is the most conductive metal. I think copper is right after that. Gold is after that. What the beauty of gold and why everything's coated in gold is not necessarily that it's highly conductive, but that it's much less likely to be corroded. And that's sort of why. It's a very inert metal, and so that's why it has the lowest anodic index. So they set the lowest anodic index at absolute zero, and all the other ones have a higher number. So that's sort of the reason why. Yes, Hank.
M1YDY, got your answer. So you just corrected me. So what I said before was wrong. You know, I was under the assumption that the reason why they gold plate circuit boards and everything is not for conductivity, but for corrosion, which makes more sense. Okay, good to know. I got to keep that in mind. I probably knew this somewhere, but forgot. So, good. Go ahead. Thanks, Roy, for that, because I thought that silver was more conductive than gold anyway, so that's the reason. Hank, go ahead. You can answer this. Go ahead.
Yeah, N1YDY. Awful long time since beginning electronics class back when I was in high school, but the bottom line, as I recall it, and please, Roy, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the problem with silver is that while it's a really easy metal to make it work as a conductor, it does have a real issue with corrosion.
Yeah, you're correct. It does have it oxidizes. That's the tarnish that people polish silver with all the time but there are different things. But you know, as a theoretical basis, is silver, pure silver in an inert gas where there's no oxidation, has a higher conductivity than any other elemental metal. You'd have to go to superconductors to be better.
Okay, thank you. And one whitey white clear.
Okay, thanks, Hank. Anybody else, by the way, with any comments on what has been said so far? Okay, very good. It's almost 9 o'clock, so we're running right on schedule here. All right, so, as I said, I'm just going to repeat just a few sentences here. Let's have potential can be measured with a voltmeter and measured in volts. And it's what Alessandro Volta discovered and made the use to create the voltaic coil, which is, as we know, is a battery. Because electropotential is a relative difference, it is measured as a voltage with respect to some material. The voltage is a metal's anodic index, and I keep forgetting how to pronounce it, anodic, A-N-O-D-I-C, index with respect to gold as the reference material, so they're using gold. And there's a table here which shows the anodic series for materials common in our stations. And again, you know, it shows here that gold has an index of zero, and that's either solid or plated. And then the silver is the next one, which they reference to gold, nickel, copper, brass, bronzes, and stainless steel. There's different types of stainless steels, tin plate, iron. Iron, that's wrought iron. That's really iron. Do you say the iron or iron? It's really pronounced iron. Wrought iron. Ray or metallic, let's see, plain carbon, low alloy steels, aluminum, there's wrought aluminum alloy, and there's different numbers, hot dip, zinc plate, galvanized steel, which, you know, most of our towers are galvanized. They don't rust, which is one of the pluses because of galvanic action, because of the plating that's on it. Zinc is another one. And, you know, that's the basis for a battery, carbon-zinc batteries. There is a list of the materials that they reference the goal to, goal being having a zero number. I should say a zero index. By the way, this is WH2CDL, and you're listening to Andy's Corner.
A late check-in?
Yep, admission is free. Come on in.
Whiskey Alpha 2, Charlie Delta Lima. Thank you. It's Russell and Quorum, Alpha Delta 2, Bravo, Oscar, 82BO.
Okay, very good. Just grab a seat in the back, and there's plenty of room. Just don't forget, wear the mask and keep your distance. I have to make fun because it's become such a norm. I have to tell you that even when I don't have to wear a mask because I'm, you know, not around people and I'm outside, I put it on anyway just to force a habit. I'm so used to doing it now. It's becoming a way of life. I'm sure for other people too.